Good afternoon, everyone. This is the Senate Committee on Veterans and Emergency Preparedness. Rather than keep people waiting, I know that Senator Bokus will be here shortly. I would like to start out by reading an excerpt from Portraits of Women Combat Veterans. I feel this is the year of women in the military. And this is from Sergeant Catherine Broom, who's in the Virginia Army National Guard. She says, our whole medical section was female. I think that says a lot that we have a natural maternal instinct to take care of these people. The fact that I'm a female probably made it a little bit harder to see all these young boys getting hurt. Men can look at it and say, that's a soldier. Women can look at it and say, that's somebody's son. No physical aspects were any harder. The jobs that we were tasked to perform were still done to standard, but the humanity and psychological toll of some of these things we saw made it harder on us because we turned these casualties into humans with girlfriends and wives. I think that we brought more humanity to the actions that we were performing. There were three female pilots in my unit, and female door gunners, and female crew chiefs and medics. And we're not standing in Kuwait in a safe place. We're not completely hidden from what's actually going on, and we're not immune to the things that people envision only the infantrymen seeing. I think people forget that this war does not have a front line. This war is fought all over the place, every hour of the day, and there is no marching up and facing each other and pulling out your muskets. This is people with rocket launchers in the back of pickup trucks pulling up, pointing it toward where they might hit something good, and where they hit is not full of women, men, it's full of everyone. And that's the little topic for today. I would like to open a public hearing on House Bill 2034 and call up Roy Denny. Is Roy going to start this off? Roy Denny? Okay. And then Lewis Pitt from the Confederated Tribes and Mike Wakola.
Madam Chair and members of the committee, House Bill 2034 permits tribal government to submit applications for federal funding related to emergency programs and services through the Office of Emergency Management, that's OEM, for review and or processing. It acknowledges tribal government may establish emergency management agencies, requires tribal government, that chooses to establish an emergency management agency to appoint an emergency program coordinator and establish policies as specified jointly with the county within which the tribal government operates, requires tribal emergency management agency to perform certain specified functions within territorial limits.
Welcome.
Madam Chairman, members of the committee, I'm Brigadier General Mike Caldwell. I'm the Deputy Director of the Oregon Military Department. We asked the governor to pre-file this bill based on meetings that we've been having with the tribal governments. As you know, the government-to-government meetings have been going on for several years now, and this came up as an issue in those meetings that several of the tribes, three tribes that currently have emergency management programs, but they were excluded from applying for this money until we have a state legislative action. So once we recognize that, we ask the governor to pre-file the bill. This is the bill. This actually puts them in line to with their program to seek some Homeland Security grant money or some emergency management performance grant money. Just so kind of frame the network, here several years ago in the mid, say probably 2005, 2006 was kind of the high water mark on both of these grants. Oregon was receiving about $9 million annually from the federal government. Today, the Homeland Security grant has basically gone down by 70%. It's around $3 million. And the Emergency Management Performance Grant is down about 30%. It's down around $6 million. So the grant money has gone downhill, but nonetheless, these out of the nine tribes, three of them have very effective and operational emergency management programs. And this is kind of a quirk in the federal law that caused it not to be eligible to seek these funds. And with that, again, it's our bill. We would like to see it passed. And I'll let these two gentlemen who actually are on the ground talk about it. Louis?
All right. Louis Pitt, Jr., Confederated Tribes of Warm Springs Government Affairs and Planning. Yes, we have land that we do take care of, manage directly, the 650,000 acres or 1,000 square miles of the reservation itself. We have emergency needs, some help from, I think, the Forest Service, and we very much are in need of, I think, working with trying to get acquire all the dollars we can to help us with the emergency needs that we have. And so we're in a fire-dependent zone. Half the reservation is forestry lands, and the other half is, pardon me, is range lands that occasionally burns also. So we also do have off-reservation lands, too, that are a government thing held in trust for us that we also have to do emergency plans for. And so anyway, it's appreciated that the state is looking to fixing a problem that, again, is some oversight that, again, I think the need for Warm Springs is great, and we're doing what we can with the limited funds we have, and looking forward to assisting however we can in passage of HB 2034. So thank you, committee.
Thank you. If you're here, you might as well testify.
For the record, my name is Ray Denny, and I'm the Public Safety Director for the Confederated Tribes of the Umatilla Indian Reservation. And Chairman Boquist, thank you for your time today. The Confederated Tribes of the Umatilla Indian Reservation is made up of the Cayuse, Umatilla, and Walla Walla. I'll use the acronym. The CTUIR is a federally recognized tribal government pursuant to 1855 Treaty with the United States. It's governed by constitution and bylaws and has an elected 9-member board of trustees. And I apologize. Board of Trustees member Armin Minthorn would have been here today, but we had two tribal member deaths, and so he is attending to those services. But with the board's interest to protect and promote, enhance the treaty, and reserve the rights and sovereign rights of our government. And as you're probably aware, the tribe meets regularly with the Oregon through the governor's office, state legislator, various agencies, and on a government-to-government basis. The Umatilla Indian Reservation is approximately 172,000 acres in northeast Oregon. The ceded land encompasses 6.4 million acres in northeast Oregon and southeast Washington. The tribe provides all essential governmental services to reservation residents, Indian and non-Indian, including police and fire protection, which resides in public safety, along with water, sewer, zoning, land use planning, and other services. Also, in the handout that I gave you, you also see that we have a major Union Pacific rail line that crosses through the reservation, along with a BPA power line, transmission line, a Northwest gas distribution line. And we do have the Umatilla River, which is an anadromous fish stream, and the tribe operates hatcheries on the Umatilla River. The CTUIR established an independent emergency management agency program in 2003, covering the tribal members and the general public living and working within the reservation. For this bill, working through the state tribal public safety cluster, we brought attention to the Oregon Office of Emergency Management, our need to apply for the federal funding, which is the Emergency Management Performance Grant. The acronym is the EMPG grant. To sustain and enhance all hazard emergency management capabilities. For instance, recent events we've had out on the tribe, we have I-84 that crosses through the reservation. In December, we had the bus crash where we had 36 individuals, some trapped in the bus. Our tribal police and fire were the first responders on the scene. We ended up having first responders from throughout the area, probably 100 plus paramedics, police officers on scene. Probably one of the largest mass casualty incidents that we've had in that area. In 2003, the Department of Homeland Security defines tribes as local governments. And while federally recognized tribes have a unique federal tribe government to government relationship, They are, at this time, they're unable to receive the EMP grant, apply for the EMP grant funding. It was an opinion of an Oregon Attorney General that the tribes are not eligible because they're not listed under the list of entities that may apply, which is ORS 401.305. Therefore, under current state statute, OEM negotiates funds with emergency management allocated by the state and counties to municipalities for the EMPG program, and tribes are not eligible to apply. House Bill 2034 authorized amendments to ORS 401.096, allowing tribal governments to apply for state-negotiated U.S. Department Homeland Security Management funds and to ORS 401.305, which would include federally recognized tribes to the list of governments eligible to receive emergency management performance grant funds to conduct emergency management programs. In 2013, Oregon Emergency Management has kind of leaned forward and has included a 3.4% tribal set-aside on the population based on the population of the nine federally recognized tribes. The 3.4 set-aside would come out of the state's 20% allocation of EMPG funds. Therefore, the funds allocated for counties and cities would not be impacted except for the final budget that's approved by the federal government, which is distributed to the states. The tribe appreciates Governor Kitzhaber and Oregon Emergency Management staff introduction of this legislation to recognition of tribal government emergency management planning needs. The tribe is pleased that the Oregon House recommended passage House Bill 2034 by unanimous vote. We've also received a vote of support from the Oregon Association of Chief of Police, and we urge the Senate's Veterans Service and Emergency Preparedness Committee and the Oregon legislature to vote favorable for House Bill 2034. Thank you for your time, and is there any questions?
Thank you very much. A quick question on the Umatilla. I'm just looking at your map here, and it's been a topic of discussion in the past, so we're seeking your advice. Have you, in your recollection, have you had any issues with the Chevron pipeline, which is, as you know, the Salt Lake City to Spokane pipeline, or with the natural gas pipeline, in terms of spills, sorts of things like that?
We did have, there was a leak, and I believe it was the gas line, and I think it's probably been close to 10 years ago where we did have an explosion, and luckily it was out in an area where non-residential area, kind of out in rangeland, and so it put up a rather large ball of flame for a while until it was put out. Had some impact on the environment in the area, but yes, there has been one incident, but otherwise that's the only major incident that I'm aware of with those lines.
And one other question. I believe General Caldwell is vaguely familiar with this, and I'll say vaguely because I'm going to leave it at vague. There is an effort afoot to do more coordination at the Department of Homeland Security for major infrastructure projects like pipelines, so on and so forth, and my concern is that to make sure that the tribal entities, which are nation states in my mind, are involved in that process, because you have all these oil pipelines and gas pipelines and everything going across there. And so I don't know if you're familiar with involvement or active involvement with Department of Homeland Security and studies.
I think in relation to the pipelines that you mentioned, to the best of my knowledge, the tribe's been working directly with, say, Chevron and Northwest Gas. I would say that they're very good about updating us on their emergency plans. They usually come out once a year and meet with the tribe. So I would say from that aspect, the companies have reached out to the tribe to make sure that we're prepared in case we did have an emergency or an incident out there, and then how they would respond. I'm not aware of a relation to Homeland Security, though, in relation to those transmission lines.
The only recommendation I have is before you leave, the director of that department is sitting behind you, and I think he knows exactly what I'm talking about. I really don't want to comment, General Caldwell, because I don't think we ought to comment. But There are some planning efforts that are going on right now, and because you're a separate, both tribes are separate governmental entities, that, you know, best way to represent yourself is to be at the table too, because it's hard for us, and I don't think it's OEM and the state's responsibility to represent another government in that faction. But there are some planning processes that have suddenly jumped up in the last couple of months that would be of most interest to the tribes, I'm sure.
Mr. Chairman, just to add to that, yes, indeed, critical infrastructure is ongoing within the department. These monies are used for that. You're precisely correct. It is a major interest of the federal government that we have those, all the critical infrastructure in the state identified, and some of the more vulnerable ones. We look at that and assess it to try to take action. A lot of that's private industry.
Yeah.
You know, it could be, like you said, the Chevron pipeline. That's a critical infrastructure item. And sometimes it's difficult to get private companies to share a lot of good information with you. But we're working on that. We're continuing to work on it. It's going to be a long-term process. It's not going to be an overnight one fell swoop, which is why I think these monies are perfectly designed for that, so we can with the money you can exact a result.
Yeah, I'm aware that the private sector has received an invitation they can't refuse, and so I just want to make sure that the tribal governments aren't left out in the cold, so that they know what's going on as independent entities of what's going on, because I have just been made aware in the last week of these invitations. So, Madam Vice Chair, questions?
No.
Senator Courtney?
No.
Appreciate your testimony and look forward to having a work session this in the near future.
Thank you, Committee.
You're most welcome. Is there anybody else that wants to speak to this issue? If not, then we're going to close the public hearing on HB 2034, and we're going to open a public hearing on HB 2044. Council, if you would, Mr. Smith and Kelly.
Brashears.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 2044 authorizes Oregon Department of Veterans Affairs, the ODVA, to establish, by rule, reasonable compensation for ordinary and unusual services rendered by ODVA as conservator and personal representative, removes the ceiling on ODVA's compensation of 5% of income under its management in a veteran's estate, declares emergency effective on passage. This also came out of House Committee and off the House floor with a unanimous vote.
Directors.
Good afternoon, Chair Boquist, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Cameron Smith, Director of the Oregon Department of Veterans Affairs. And on this gorgeous spring day, we are inside testifying because these bills are important, both to the governor and to the agency and to all of our veterans. Our conservatorship program is under our Veterans Services Division. It's a small program compared to our larger claims and counseling. Serves about 160 veterans that the agency serves as the conservator when a court or the federal VA deems a veteran not able to manage their finances or their estate and their assets. And I have Kelly Brashears up here with me, and she is the big brain behind this program. She is also the heart and soul of it. Her mother was a longtime employee of ODVA, and I will let her speak to the specifics of what the program does and how this strengthens that. But first, at a high level, one of the central conundrums that ODVA faces is the strength of our home loan program and what we rely on that as a subsidy for our other core services. As part of the governor's budget, we had a fund shift request go through Ways and Means to the tune of $1.6 million to carve out our claims and counseling from being funded by the home loan program. These two bills, specifically for 2044, for this one, but our comments will also speak to 2046, the following bill. This is a way for us to make the conservatorship program sustainable financially long-term as a benefit. Right now, approximately 300,000 comes off of the home loan program in terms of our reserves account to fund the conservatorship program. So this would be strengthening our loan program and making sure those reserves go to pay back the debts on those loans. And I will turn it over to Kelly for the bigger view on the actual program.
And before you do that, I'm going to open a public hearing on HB 2046. So go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Kelly Brashears, as Cameron said, the the conservatorship manager with the Oregon Department of Veterans Affairs. As he said also, I have a long history with the department. I've been with the department for 12 years, but I've grown up there since I was probably 7, so at some point it'll seem strange not to come around. So I'm here today to kind of explain a little bit about what our program does and the people that we serve. Our conservatorship program, let me start first by distinguishing conservatorship from guardianship. We do not perform guardianship services. Guardianship services would be making medical decisions, life decisions, end-of-life decisions, where someone lives, those types of decisions. We do not make decisions like that for our clients. We are strictly estate planning and financial management. So we are appointed by a court, circuit court, at this point. We are planning, hopefully, to expand our program. But at this point, we are only court-appointed. And the court appoints us. Generally, the court will appoint a third party, meaning not a family member, as a last resort. People who either don't have family members or have family members who have been deemed unsuitable to serve in these positions. And so we take a lot of cases that are very difficult cases. About 90% of our clients have very severe mental health issues. A lot of them don't live on their own. They live in either nursing homes or pseudo-locked facilities. There's not really locked facilities in Oregon anymore, but what we would equate to a locked facility where they're not allowed to leave without some kind of supervision because of their mental health illness. And so they're very difficult cases. What we do is available in the private sector. There are private professional fiduciaries that do what we do. They charge anywhere between $80 and $100 an hour for their services, which is not anywhere near what we charge for our services. The thing about our clients is that a lot of the private sector do not want to take veterans. And it has nothing to do with the fact that they don't want to serve veterans. It has everything to do with the fact that they don't want to deal with the federal VA. The federal VA in 2008 did a consolidation of all of their conservatorship or fiduciary services to a hub in Salt Lake City, and we were hoping actually that it would become a little bit easier. That's not been the case. Dealing with the federal VA on a day-to-day basis is what we do in every section of our agency, so to us it's not really that big of a deal, but to the private sector, dealing with a federal agency every day on clients, they don't want to do it. Many of the private sector who had a lot of veterans actually went to the courts and found people to replace them. We took on some of those clients. This was about 2009. And so it's become more difficult in the private sector to find somebody even to serve as a guardian for a client that we are the conservator for. We kind of have to beg, borrow, plead, steal, do whatever we can do to work our networking relationships to get people to serve because they just don't want to deal with them. So the clients that we serve definitely are in need. And would have to have a conservator whether our program existed or not. Someone would have to serve in this capacity. Our program right now charges about 5% of income, which is an average about $175 a month per client. And I say average, some of it's much less, some we don't charge fees at all. We have about a 15% pro bono rate right now for clients, veterans who are either on Medicaid or for whatever reason can't afford to pay for services. We waive all of our fees on those services. What we charge right now for the average client is about a third of what the private sector charges. We don't charge for things, and this is just the hourly fee. We don't charge for other things such as postage, faxes, photocopies, travel time, mileage. All of those things are extensions of what a private guardian or conservator would charge the client. We don't charge for those. Basically, what this bill is going to allow us to do is to increase that fee. We're wanting to move remove the cap from statute and move it into an administrative rule process so that we can have our program become more self-sufficient. We certainly aren't even thinking about raising it enough to cover the rest of the cost of this program. That's just not going to happen. But it will allow, as the director said, to kind of alleviate some pressure off the loan program. The average increase per veteran is not going to be a noticeable amount for them, but it will make a big difference for our program in the long run and hopefully allow us to continue to provide the services that we're providing. Any questions?
Sure. Focus members of the committee, to bring it back home, when a veteran is not able to pay the current fee, or if we increase the fee by 3%, we still have that waiver in place. And House Bill 2046 speaks to when we give a, so there's often a time when a veteran may have illiquid assets in their name. So on a day-to-day, they can't pay out of if they own their own home. But at the end of their life, that asset is, you know, if we give them a waiver to allow them to not to be participating in the conservatorship program, to be able to recoup some of those costs on the back end when those assets become liquid again. So that is the second piece of the two conservatorship bills.
Council, would you just give us a brief overview of 2046, and then we'll go to Senator Courtney.
Chair Boquist, members of the committee, House Bill 2046 is the companion piece to 2044, allows the Oregon Department of Veterans Affairs to recuperate the cost of conservatorship from an estate of a deceased client, permits ODVA to retract a waiver of a claim for costs if it finds a payment will no longer result in a hardship and doesn't deplete the estate. It tolls claims against the estate from the date the claim was waived to the date the waiver is retracted. Again, unanimous vote out of committee and of House floor.
Senator Courtney, your question.
Director Captain Smith, I don't understand a lot about what this is. I know what a conservatorship is and everything, but so I'm going to go to the summary of the financial, the revenue impact. It says the 13-15 and 15-17 is $260,000 of other funds. So this bill hasn't been to Ways and Means, clearly. What is this other funds? Explain the $260,000 figure, where that came from, where that money's coming from, because I don't understand how this is paying us for itself. Is your general fund money going to be needed? I just am completely confused about the funding of this program.
Chair Boquist, Senate President Courtney, currently the loan program and its reserve subsidizes to the tune of $290,000. So I think that possibly is where those numbers are coming from. That is still other funds, but the other funds would be made up not with general fund, but by increasing this fee. So still another funds, but just not the reserve program funds.
So if we pass this, we're not going to have to worry about February session coming in saying, well, we need more money, general fund money. Is it solvent enough the way you're doing it that given some of the problems you're having, whether it's the feds or whether it's your clients, the veterans and the mental illness, that you're not going to be underfunded? I understand you're using the Home Veterans Program to subsidize this. Is that right?
Correct.
All right. And then you go to the veteran, him or herself, and you take a fee from them some way, right?
Correct.
Where does that money come from?
Existing law is 5%.
Well, what do you get? Whatever money they have in their life, where are they getting their 5%? I mean, where's that money coming from a veteran?
Senator Courtney, the 5% is a 5% of income. So when we initially get a client, say they have $1 million in the bank, that is an asset. It is not income for our purposes. And so we don't take a fee on that. We take a fee on their monthly income, which would be 5%, and actually not even all of their monthly income.
Suppose they don't have an income. I mean, these veterans, they're in a veterans hospital. Suppose they don't have an income.
Then we would take them and our fee would be waived, basically. I mean,
and you know how many of those you're speculating they're going to be out there you can waive and you still have enough to fund the program?
Yes. I mean, we average about a 15, somewhere between 15 to 20% pro bono. And generally, the clients like that who are in homes really don't. I try not to think about it this way, but we kind of do a cost-benefit analysis when we take a client. Are we really actually going to be able to perform a service for this veteran? Or is a rep payee, which is kind of, it's not a court appointment, it's a VA-appointed fiduciary, could they perform the services that we would be providing?
One last question. Do you turn any veterans down?
Only when we are full. I mean, we have in the past got to a point where we can't take on any more clients. And the only time I've ever done that, when I first took over the program in 2008, we hadn't had a new client in 18 months. And just because there was no referrals coming in. And so I went out and I got our name back out there, started drumming up business, so to speak, at least telling people about our program, letting people know that we exist. That's really what it was about, was that nobody knew that we existed. We started getting in clients at a rate so quickly that our staff couldn't handle the intake of them. So there are times when, and then that was one of them, where we kind of stopped taking in referrals for a short period of time just so we could get caught up on the initial. When we take in an initial client, it's about 40 hours worth of work. We have a staff of 7 people, including myself. Mm-hmm. To manage the 160 clients we have and then do the intake on the new ones. So it doesn't happen often, and we try not to do it strictly because we know that there's a need out there, and it's so hard for these people to find other ways or other means of getting this service.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
And Vice Chair?
So it's, my question was, how many clients do you serve in a year? And you right now said you had 160?
Currently, we have 160. Some of those clients we've been serving since our program started in 1965. So we've had them that long.
Yeah.
We basically got them in their 20s when they got out of service with either severe mental illness or severe. A lot of them from back then had traumatic brain injury. It's kind of those things that we're seeing now from the guys coming out. And so we've had some of our clients that long. A lot of the ones that have kind of been short-term passing through our program recently are World War II veterans and Korea veterans who kind of are at the end stages of life, need somebody to do this, but end up within 6 to 8 months passing away, which is, you know, we're more than happy to do what we can to serve them at the end of their life and help their families out.
Thank you.
Sarah Olson.
Thank you, Chair Boquist. What would you say would be the average income of your clients?
I actually went and did a spreadsheet before I came here, and the average income of our clients is somewhere between $3,000 and $3,300
a month.
Most of our clients are 100% service-connected veterans. A lot of them, because of the mental health illnesses that they have, are receiving special monthly compensation on top of that. So the standard rate for 100% is $2,900 a month, and then you would receive an extra. They would receive an extra $600 to $700 a month for a special monthly compensation. And again, at the low end of that scale, we have a lot of people who have just Social Security benefits and are on, you know, the 20%, 15 to 20% that's pro bono. Most of those are Medicaid clients who either, I think we only have one client right now who doesn't have a monthly income per se. He has, his father left some money to him and he gets the dividends from that money monthly, but doesn't, we only have one client who doesn't actually have a monthly income.
Hello. Thank you. Where do these folks normally reside at? Are they in homes or VA homes, or are they in private homes?
We have clients in all walks of life. We have clients who own their homes. We have 40 of our 160 clients own real property. We have a property manager who manages those properties along with his own caseload, a much smaller caseload than the other trust officers. And so we have, like I said, people who are very independent. They have driver's licenses. If you met them on the street, you'd probably never know that they had a conservator. They don't have any outward signs of having mental illness. We have the other end of the spectrum where we have veterans who are at the Oregon Veterans Home under nursing home contract who will probably, unfortunately, never leave that facility. People who have very severe MS, things like that. So it's kind of a wide range. I would probably say we've people in foster homes, people in facilities, people who live in apartments who don't actually own their own homes, but they do live independently. It's probably half and half. Probably about half of our clients live in facilities and then half live independently.
Director Smith, you want us to give you the authority to put this in the rules instead of coming back to us every 2 years, 3 years, asking for a fee increase? Is that the case?
Chair Boquist, Senator Olson, it is not in the interest of ODVA to set this rate at such a level that it's in competition with the private sector. Kind of a combo between your question and Senate President Courtney's question. What's going to allow this program and breathe life into this program is setting it at such a level, having the flexibility on an ongoing basis to set it at a level that it can become self-sustaining without becoming a drain on the general fund or on the other funds of the loan program reserves. I feel comfortable with that. The House felt comfortable with that. There is that give and take, to be very honest, on when we set fees at an agency level or whether it's coming back to the legislature for that authority.
One final question. Sorry, Chair. What are you running this program at a deficit now? And what is that amount?
So right now, Chair Boquist, Senator Olson, $290,000 per biennium comes out of the loan program reserves. There is a slice of general fund appropriated right now as well. Do you have a rough sense of that one?
I do not. Our fees right now total are about 60% of our budget. So the other comes from a combination of the 290 with the, from the loan program, and then a very small slice of general fund money. And Nick's going to save us.
So if you were to raise your fees, would that percentage stay the same?
So Chair Boquist, Senator Olson, I think the general fund appropriation would stay the same, and we would stop draining on the reserve side of the house to make sure both of these programs can continue course. And I would say it's hard to judge under current conditions, both with our Vietnam aging population and the newer influx of Iraq and Afghanistan. We don't anticipate that general fund appropriation would grow, and we would look to try to build this from within. And beyond setting of the fees, Kelly has done a great job in terms of a strategic plan. What can we do to, just what she talked about, folks didn't know our name out there, didn't know that this was a good option for our veterans. We don't want to build this program because we don't want to have more veterans out there that can't manage their finances. But if they're out there, we are one of the best places for them to get that service. We're looking at expanding into not just managing all of the income and assets, but looking at representative payees. So we could just sign some folks up to pay the bills. That would be another slice at a fair fee rate for that service that would help kind of expand the base of the program to make sure the whole thing can continue on.
So, Director Smith, my understanding of 2046 is that under the first program, if you're waiving the fees, right, there's obviously an accounting system, welcome to government, and then at the point when they pass away, you then have the latitude under the other bill, 2046, to make a claim against the estate in the amount of those previously waived fees. Is that not correct?
Chair Boquist, I would say that's correct. Would you agree?
Yes. The 2046 basically allows us to do what other state agencies, DHS, through their institutional revenue section and their estate administration unit, those are the people who provide both state hospital stays and Medicaid services. It would put us in that same category where we would be allowed to recoup some of our fees, probably not in the same order because there's an order within probate statute of who recoups fees. But this also allows us, I can give you kind of an example. We had recently one of our veterans became Social Security eligible. She's been on waived fees for many, many, many years because she couldn't afford to pay the fees. And actually, we've gone to two court hearings where we paid the attorney general fees who represented us, which normally would come from the estate. So there was a lot of waived fees on this particular case. She got a $10,000 retro from Social Security, and we didn't have the ability to recoup those fees. We ended up, normally what would happen, she also has a guardian. We ended up paying all of those fees because she was on Medicaid. We had to bring her back under the Medicaid limit. We ended up paying all of those fees to the guardian, which we certainly didn't have a problem sharing that money with the guardian because they provided services as well. But it would have been nice to kind of recoup a little bit of our fees from.
I'll let Senator Courtney go first because I have another question.
Go ahead.
Go ahead. You first.
Well, I support the bill. So now you tell me there is general fund money. How much general fund money is in this program?
Chair Boquist, Senator Courtney, we'll have to get back to you on the exact for this biennium.
Really interesting. I don't understand why that doesn't show up on this sheet, because it doesn't. The revenue, I don't quite get this.
Well, Mr. President, we'll put the inquiry into LRO and LFO, but there's not much we can do about it.
Well, no, I understand that. And by the way, I think, given by your aggressive nature, which I congratulate, Kelly, that you, by your own admission, when you advertised the program, they came in large numbers. I don't know, but and I don't know when the age would start. You wouldn't necessarily have to be much old to be really old. Let's talk about me to have a conservatorship. You do understand. So, given the magnitude of what we see coming back out of Iraq and Afghanistan, I think the your waivers are going to increase dramatically. They're going to increase dramatically. I'm just going to say that right here and now. I don't think it's possible not to admit that, which means either you're going to move dramatically in the case towards fees, so those who can't afford to increase that, or the home loan, or more general fund money. So I just think that should be on the record. And again, I don't oppose the program at all, but I do think that just by your own testimony, listen to very carefully, you get the word out, this program, people, these veterans really respond to this. And we're seeing with the veterans coming back from our most recent terrifying conflicts, we've got something on our hands we really don't quite understand in terms of trying to deal with treatment as well as other things. So I just think that needs to be on the record. And again, I'll support the bill. It's a great concept. I'm there. But I am a little... I just would like to know a little bit about the general fund money as well as whether or not your own speculation is such that this thing, you're going to have to waive a whole lot more. Your percentages of 20%, you're going to go in, you're going to go much higher than that.
Chair Boquist, Senate President Courtney, one thing that I think is reassuring is, you know, we have some 340,000 veterans. We're currently serving 160 in this program. Not every veteran who gets a conservatorship comes to ODVA. Some of these are the most challenging cases. So, you know, our 15 to 20% that we have waived has remained constant. We will continue to monitor that and report back. We'll get the better answer on the general fund appropriation. So we're not the only game in town, which is part of the reassurance, I think.
I'm not reassured because you're going to be the only game in town here shortly. So if you'd be kind enough to come back next week and outline, you know, I'm really interested to know what type of veterans in here, what generations they're from. Senator Courtney has raised an issue of the existing generation, which is Iraq and Afghanistan, where we come from. But, I mean, what the red flag flashing up behind you on that wall back there is that the Vietnam generation is now coming in to play, and that's where you get a big next big bump. And it's also the same bump we're seeing huge suicide spikes in. And the question is how do we plan 2 years, 4 years, and 6 years from now for the solvency of a program that we can't do without because the feds are going to dump on us and can't be trusted, even if they're in the room. So therefore, need a little bit more detail and a little bit more future. You know, where are we paying for it from general fund? You know, what's the percentages going to? You know, what kind of a program can we build forward with this? The definition of reasonable compensation, I don't know. I mean, it's 5% is what was in here before. I don't know what reasonable is. And I think, you know, what's the rulemaking authority to get that? I know you have an oversight board, which has got a lot of great veterans on it, which I'm assuming would be the people that have something to do with this rulemaking authority. But we're about to face a very austere fiscal situation in the federal government. And so they're going to dump on us because they don't care. And we're going to pick it up. And so it'd be better to know, because I agree with the Senate President on this particular issue, that we're going to do this. But the question is we better know now what we're going to face 6 months, 2 years, or at least have a forecast in front of us of a good idea of how we're going to claw our way out of this thing. Because if you advertise it, they will come. That's what's going to happen here. And we're at a point where we're seeing this huge spike again in the Vietnam era people, and we haven't even touched because thank God for medicine and modern medicine, but the issues we're going to face after a 12-year war in Afghanistan and Iraq with individuals with traumatic brain injury, PTSD, and about 15-20% of them missing a limb, and when the free medical from the feds walk away, we're going to have a big problem there. And it doesn't matter whether we agree or disagree, it doesn't matter what party you're in, we're going to inherit it at this level. And so this is going to grow. And to be, well, again, I'm very supportive with the Senate President. I can't speak for the other two members, but it'd be nice, like in other programs now, to start figuring out today what we're going to do in 2 years, 4 years, and 6 years.
Chair, sure. If I might, real quick, I just wanted to say I do actually have a business plan that I did. I come from a business background, and so I did a business plan it's a 4-year business plan. It has not been updated for some employee issues that we've had where we've had some staff go out, and I need to adjust the numbers because we're a little bit behind the eight ball on some things, but we have taken that into account. We understand that the baby boomers are coming of age, so to speak, and it's not just us that's seeing an increase in that, it's professional fiduciaries across the state. And as a state goes, we do not have a whole lot of professional fiduciaries in this state. Compared to other states, the number of people doing this type of work, it's really small. We do actually have 3 Iraqi Freedom veterans right now under our program, unfortunately. all of them with traumatic brain injury, and all of them are very challenging cases. So I just kind of wanted to reassure you that, unfortunately, we do know what's coming down the stream, and I would be more than happy to update that plan and give you a copy of it to kind of show you where our plan is to move forward from here.
And can we do that over the next 7 days?
We can do that tomorrow.
The reason this is important is, may I borrow these, Mr. President?
Sure, go ahead.
I mean, these aren't accurate, and there's nobody at this diocese that can make these accurate. And so the issue comes down to is if they don't know down in legislative, fiscal, and legislative revenue what we're facing 2, 4, 6 years, these experts that are down there, we're going to be surprised here. We have, I don't need to tell anybody in this room, we have a healthcare crisis that's, you know, looks like we're not falling off the Grand Canyon. We're trying to scale the wall from the bottom to the top. And so what we want to do is make sure that those people understand downstairs and the people that are planning forward that this is an issue that we have to address and we have to support to your agency versus us being in the position 2 years from now or whoever's here saying we have a crisis and addressing it. It's nothing on the agency. Got that. And it's nothing on the committee here. But if we're going to plan forward, we got to get the rest of the people in this building in the loop. Senator Olson, you had a question?
Yeah, I actually have two. Thank you, Chair Boquist. The first one is when you recoup the costs of someone you've had to pass over on, do you charge interest on that money?
Senator Olson, we do not charge interest, first. And second, I should say also that we don't just choose to recoup the costs. We have to have a court order for those fees. So we send in an annual accounting every year where a circuit court judge approves what we've done for that year and approves any fees that we want to charge before we charge them. In order to have a retraction of a fee waiver, we would need to make the decision to do that and then request court permission to do that, and a judge would have to sign off on it prior to us actually doing that. So,
okay, so in a year, if you, Chair
Fellow,
in a year, if you did $500 worth of service, there's at the end you would collect $500 back if the judge so agreed.
Yes, and actually, I should clarify on the 5% fee. Those are actually collected when the income comes in, but we don't actually put those in the coffer, so to speak, until our accounting has been approved. So, if the judge comes back and says no, we're not going to approve this, which we've never had happen. But if they did, we have the ability to reverse those fees and put that money back into their account. We have done that on occasion, where clients, you know, we get halfway through the year and we realize they really don't have enough money to cover expenses. We have reversed fees on clients where we've put money back into their accounts so that they can cover their prescription costs or cover whatever it is that they're needing. So we do have the ability to go back with that. Attorney general fees, we don't pay up front. Any other, we have a small property management fee for real property. We don't pay those up front. Those are all paid at the end once it's been approved by the court.
And all these fees are percentages of income. You don't have a fixed rate because if a person was poor or a person was rich, it still should take $100 to provide a service. And it seems to me that for the poor person, it's going to cost $100. For the rich person, it's going to cost $300. And I can't comprehend why the level of service would be different if it's the same exact procedure.
Senator Olson, I think probably, and I wasn't around when we put the fee in place initially. 1987 was the last time we had a fee increase, and that was actually the first time we started charging fees in this program. So prior to 1987, we didn't charge fees. They added a fee in 87 for the services. And I don't know what the thought process was behind a percentage, although I believe, and it would make sense, the federal VA, when they assign a representative payee to represent a client, a veteran, the federal rate is 4%. So they do a percentage. Social Security also does 10% or $76, whichever is less, which is kind of a little confusing. Yes, thank goodness we're not at the point where we're dealing with that. But I think that's probably why they went with a percentage, because other governmental agencies, that's how they paid. So I think they stuck with a percentage. And it kind of actually makes a little bit of sense, just because if we're doing, you know, if we charged $100 an hour for our services, we would charge a veteran who had $100 left in their budget versus somebody who had $600 left in their budget. I think the thought process was trying to be fair to, depending upon how much income they have, and that was kind of, I think, the thought process behind that.
Any questions, Madam Vice Chair? Mayor Courtney?
No.
If you could come back next week, and the importance of that is putting it on the record. If you just email it in here, it won't get downstairs and it won't be on as much of the record. I think we need to kind of walk through this because I anticipate, I don't quite understand the fee other than that I do understand if they have $100, you don't want to take all $100. If they have $10,000, it's more to manage. There's all kinds of accounting things, so on and so forth. I kind of get that. But the biggest concern is that Senator Courtney has made us all aware of previous issues that predate any of you in veterans programs, and if we're going to be looking at a program that we know frankly loses money right now and it's going to increase in size, then we need to have it on record of, you know, how we're going to balance this plane or where we're going to go, because we can't do without the service. That's I don't think anybody here, I see everybody nodding, but we're not going to do it without the service, so we're going to do it. The question is we need to have a better record that we can get LRO and LFO on board of saying, hey, this is going to be going like this, and we need to anticipate it, and we need to put it in our existing documentation before we pass this bill out that says this is going to start growing in the future, and we know that's going to be an issue, and we need to be prepared to plan for it. If not, like so many things else in the $58 billion budget we have, it will fall through the cracks, and we won't know about it. Anything else, Madam Vice Chair?
Yeah, Mr. Chair, when you come back, I would like to know what is the fee range, what's the most you've ever charged a client, and I think you gave me the percentage of how much are pro bono. I would find that interesting.
Senator Anderson, when you say, I just want to make sure I clarify and understand what you're asking for. You're asking for a dollar amount mm-hmm. fee range? Okay.
Any other takeaways? Colleagues, we appreciate your hard work, and we appreciate your work on behalf of these veterans, too. And please don't assume we're beating you up. We're simply trying to get this on the record to figure out where we're going to go in the future, because the reason we have a young director is he's going to get old real quick when all the rest of these veterans are coming to the agency.
Chair Boquist, members of the committee, I think, as I sit here and noodle on it, there's a lot of crossovers when we look at the same, you know, the older generation coming. The demands that we see for veterans for long-term care and skilled nursing. We only have one facility for 151 veterans. We're building out the second facility in Lebanon. There's going to be fascinating discussions with the department, with our veterans community and the legislature and the governor of how do we provide those services, not just through the Oregon Department of Veterans Affairs, but across our system, whether it's suicide prevention and awareness, whether it's long-term skilled nursing, whether it's the conservatorship program. Not all of them are going to boom in terms of our core programs at the agency, but we still need to plan on how we're going to serve our veterans.
We just noticed it looks like you're getting gray hair now already.
Hopefully not.
Any other questions, colleagues? With that, I'm going to close the public hearing on HB 2044 and 2046. Madam Counsel, we'll come back to these next week. Members, we just have public hearings again next week and no work sessions. Anything for the good of the order, Madam Vice Chair? And thank you for opening and proceeding. Appreciate that. With that, the Senate Committee on Veterans and Emergency Repairs is closed for the day.